Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, we'll be talking with the Division Chief of Pulmonary Diseases and Critical Care Medicine, Dr. Jim Donahue, about chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD.
Christy, important topic and one that affects millions of people around the world. But first, how are you? I haven't seen you in a week or so. How you been doing?
I'm doing okay. I am a little under the weather, trying to fight my own family's illnesses and get through what seems like a long
winter. You're not obsessing about the events of the world that are unfolding in the Middle East and these debates globally on healthcare and Obama. That's not consuming you right now.
Honestly, I am so consumed by doing the doctor mommy thing with sick kids that I don't have time to know what's going on in the world. But tell me about it. How's it going out there?
Let me ask you, do you eat a big breakfast? Because we have some research that matters, and our very first one is about eating a big breakfast. What's things like in the Dr. Page household at breakfast time?
Well, unfortunately, it's not probably as nutritious as I'd like, but I found this study validating. This is about whether eating a big breakfast makes a difference in your ability to lose weight or to maintain a healthy weight.
I'd always heard that eating a breakfast is a good start to a healthy day, but I really wasn't aware, but apparently a lot of people believe that if you eat a big breakfast, you actually will lose weight by not eating more throughout the rest of the day. And this is a research study that looked at that question.
Yes, and I've always believed this was not true, because for my own life, I'll eat a big breakfast, but I'm just as hungry at lunch.
Well, it turns out that you were correct, and in the article in Nutrition Journal, which researchers in Germany followed 380 people, two-thirds of whom were obese and 100 who were not, and really looking at those who ate large breakfasts, those that ate small ones, and some that skipped them, and found out how much calories they lost or gained.
And they found out that people who ate a big breakfast actually consumed more calories in the whole day.
400 of them.
More than compared with people who ate less or skipped eating breakfast at all in the morning.
Yeah, at the end of a week, that's a half to almost a pound of weight gain.
They did find some other sort of information that people who eat breakfast may have overall healthier diets and may be overall less likely to be overweight. So some things that contradicted that. But in general, the people who were skipping or eating a light breakfast had less calories in the day and were more likely to lose weight. So that's good.
So probably those big breakfasts, if you're eating them, I hope you're really, really hungry, because you're going to have to limit your calories the rest of the day if you want to really have an impact. Speaking of limits and how people figure out what they need to do, this next research that matters is about children that have attention deficit disorder and a common problem that they face about going to the bathroom.
Yeah, so this was a study of 62 children with ADHD, or the Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, and also 124 who did not have that disorder. And they did some questionnaires about their voiding symptoms or their any problems with bedwetting or bladder control.
Yeah, we know that there's some research that suggests that children who have this ADHD have greater times of bedwetting, but this is real research that looks at all kinds of things, like their ability to actually just control their bladder or need to go to the bathroom more frequently, and the parents also rating, and it was actually fairly pervasive. I was really struck by how much more children who have this condition have problems with lots of things controlling their bladder.
Yeah, and it's not quite clear why there is this relationship. It could have to do with the medications that children with ADHD may be taking, or it may have to do with some of that impulse control. So we're not quite sure why, but it does look like that kids who have this ADHD have more problems with their bladder.
Yeah, and you know, this was a take-home message for me. Even though we don't know why, it appears that we're going to need to really educate teachers and educate lots of caregivers and family members and even doctors, because, you know, a child that's fidgeting in the classroom and the teacher thinks, oh, the child just wants to get out of the classroom, maybe a child that's really needing to go to the bathroom. And these are things I think that we're going to need to really, really deal with and make some changes.
And this next study is also something we need to be aware of, and it's about children's use of the internet and a link with teen depression symptoms. A study that was done in the Journal of Pediatrics looking at over 7,000 adolescents aged 16 to 20 and surveying them about their internet use and depression symptoms.
Yeah, and really interesting, they found that teens that spend too much time on the internet, more than 2 hours a day, and teens who spent no time on the internet actually had more problems with depression than the teens who were kind of in the middle. And while this was done in 2001, I think, you know, many years before Facebook and Twitter and all these other things, it was really interesting and suggest, I think, some profound things for what the internet means for kids who maybe have some depression.
Well, and you wonder if the ones who aren't doing internet at all may be more socially isolated, since there's so much more social connection through the internet now, or if those who are on it all the time maybe aren't interacting in other ways with kids their age. So there was also a weight link between it too.
Right, and
adolescent obesity.
You know, and I don't think there's a causal effect here. Certainly kids who are depressed may be more likely to be socially isolated, so they're looking for an outlet. And you know, but it also suggests as parents, if we were to see our child spending 4 hours on the internet a day or 5 hours, it happens maybe to a lot of children, there's maybe some red flags out there, particularly if they're not socially active and have a large social network. It's a marker, and I think we should pay attention to it. And hopefully, listeners, you're out there and letting us know your concerns. If you do, actually send us a Twitter, send us some information, use the internet, but let us know about some of your concerns.
Agreed. And this last one is one, I love this one, Adam, about storytelling, helping people with blood pressure control. It was a study looking at about 300 African-American patients with high blood pressure, and they randomly assigned about half of them to watch a series of DVDs that were featuring other patients, not actors, but real patients who struggled with their blood pressure and talked about their experiences and what they learned, and then had the rest of the patients not receive those DVDs and just go on with usual care.
Yeah, this was in the Annals of Internal Medicine, major journal out there. Even though this was a smaller study, they found significant impacts, Christy, of lowering blood pressure for the group that, and they had only seen about 90 minutes over 6 months of DVDs, but these stories of other patients in the same community and what they had done perhaps to control their blood pressure. And those people had much less blood pressure, better results than the people who had not seen those DVD stories.
During the time of the study, their systolic blood pressure, that top number, went down by 17 points compared with only 6 points in the comparison group. So
that's better than a lot of the drugs. If I got that, you know, if this was a drug, I would be, man, I'd be buying that stock.
But it really, to me, speaks to the importance of trust in you know, seeing someone else who's like you, not a doctor just giving you facts or telling you what to do, but someone who's really taken a patient perspective, talking with you about what they learned and what their experience is like. And it kind of makes sense to me that people can relate to that more, and they might be more willing to then take their medicines or to exercise or whatever that may be.
Right. And one caveat here is we're not yet ready to disseminate this around the country, because we don't know. Maybe it was the stories of in your own community. But what I really like, Christy, is that this suggests a new area of research. Maybe we should be developing these local stories, our own practice in family medicine, to tell the story of our patients to get our patients' blood pressure down. So it opens up a whole new avenue of research that I think builds community. Very exciting. Well, Christy, that probably concludes our Research That Matters, but we have had some time to talk about probably those shorter, smaller breakfasts, or smaller breakfasts may be better for calorie control at breakfast.
About a link between bladder control problems and ADHD.
About too much time on the internet is perhaps a marker for depression in teens.
And about storytelling having a benefit potentially to aid in blood pressure control. So that does conclude that portion of our show. And after the break, we'll be talking with the Division of Chief of Pulmonary Diseases and Critical Care Medicine, Dr. Jim Donahue, about chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. Jim Donahue about chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, a really critically important issue facing all people in North Carolina as well as around the United States internationally.
And we are so pleased to have with us today Dr. Jim Donahue, who is the Division Chief of Pulmonary Diseases and Critical Care Medicine and Professor of Medicine at UNC. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me here.
Dr. Donahue, we love to hear stories. We're hoping you'll be willing to share some of your own experiences today. And in particular, we'd like to start by hearing your story with how you got interested in the lungs and to where you are today.
Well, Sigmund Freud would have a field day with me, but my father actually was died of COPD and was a classic blue bloater, one of the types. He was a heavy smoker and was an Irishman and was heavy and had a lot of exacerbations. And he has one of the classic phenotypes. And I was a little boy when he passed away. It's very interesting. I was in medical. In my internship and residency, I was we had to serve in the armed forces, so I went to the Beaufort Naval Hospital in South Carolina, where I practiced internal medicine. And when I was finished, I had the opportunity to either go to Stanford, but I got this opportunity to come back to Chapel Hill for my last year, and I always loved the Tar Heel basketball team. And so I said, I'm not going to Stanford, I'm going to Chapel Hill. And then I got here, and right away the pulmonary people realized that I really did have some special skills in pulmonary. And I had done it some extra time at when I was in New Jersey and also took some electives at Columbia. So I was a little bit ahead. So anyway, they recruited me here, even to stay as a fellow. This is way back before you guys were born in 1973.
I don't know. And for our listeners, Dr. Donahue does not look that old.
I am. Remember, Adam, it's not the years, it's the miles.
Let me ask this question. You know, this pivotal experience as a child and your father passing of COPD, as we like to call it in the medical profession, help those listeners who may not really know, though, that terminology, which has been around for right. a long period of time, understand what this disease is. And, you know, I don't think many listeners would know that this is in the top five causes of disease, single disease deaths around the world. Help us understand right. a little bit about what it is and why is it so large.
Well, and those are excellent points. In fact, the COPD has become the third leading cause of death in the United States, just released. The last statistics were in 2008, it replaced stroke. And nationally, we were supposed to become number three by 2020. So it's really still accelerating.
This isn't something you've wanted to see.
No, it's not something I was, I didn't want to see that. But it makes us really redouble our efforts. But coming back, chronic bronchitis and emphysema are the two forms of COPD. Emphysema is classically, you know, your Uncle Ernie, who has a big barrel chest, who smoked heavily and was a veteran. And in the old days, every time when I was a little kid, someone would hit a home run at Yankee Stadium or Ebbets Field, you know, 10,000 luckies went to the VA hospital. Well, the last thing these guys needed were some extra lucky strikes. But anyway, so the two forms were chronic bronchitis and emphysema, and most of our patients today have both. And chronic bronchitis is sputum production, frequent colds that settle in your chest and really make you sick. And the cardinal feature of both emphysema and chronic bronchitis is you can't breathe. It's the dyspnea. And as you walk across the street, air traps in your chest. And so that shortness of breath becomes even more severe. So those are the cardinal features. A lot of cough. off. It's pretty yucky mucus production, but not everybody. But the one feature everybody has is the shortness of breath. And I just got really interested in that and trying to help people out. I care deeply about, trying to help people. That was always my motivating factor. And this was someplace I felt I could contribute.
And so what percentage of these patients with COPD are smokers or were exposed to smoke growing up?
In the United States, it's very large. We estimate there's about 20 million patients who suffer with COPD. 10 million have been diagnosed and 10 million have not yet been found. Of those in America, about 90% have a tobacco history. But even more importantly, perhaps worldwide, biomass fuel and other important exposures to charcoal and others cause the disease. So only 69% of COPD worldwide is tobacco. So let's go to Africa. You know, single room dwelling, a poorly ventilated stove where the woman cooks, and they use that to heat. They use charcoals, wood products.
And then when I'm smoking, then all of a sudden you have like a double whammy.
Absolutely. So what the intervention there isn't some big fancy drug from the United States, but it's a window or a simple pipe to exhaust the stove. And so worldwide, that's a much bigger feature. And the other feature that changed in the last 10 years is a recognition that, in all due respect to Adam, who does great work with smoking cessation, even if you stop smoking and you already have this, it goes on. It's a chronic disease. So smoking cessation, particularly in North America, is absolutely the most important thing. In fact, it's a vital sign in every patient that we see in the chest clinics at UNC, Samford, and all our outlying satellites. And so if you keep smoking, then that's the end of the game. There's nothing else does very much. But even if you stop smoking, let's say you're age 50 and you're obstructed, this condition goes on. And so a big emphasis lately has been to recognize it as a true chronic disease where the inflammation persists in the person's lung many years even after they stop smoking. So first, stop smoking. But secondly, you got to just recognize this as a chronic condition, Christine. You need to deal with it.
We're speaking with Dr. Jim Donahue, the Division Chief of Pulmonary Medicine at the University of North Carolina. Dr. Donahue, I just want to ask, I know that for Christine and I, when we take care of patients in the hospital, it's, you mentioned third leading cause of death overall, but I know it's probably even number one or two for the things we see people coming into the hospital with. I don't think, though, as a doctor, I fully appreciate when you say dyspnea and shortness of breath, what that really means in terms of a patient's lifestyle.
Yeah,
can you talk a little bit about what you're having these conversations with people? It's not something that's easy to live with, is it?
It's a terrible condition, and there's various stages of it or levels of severity. And, for example, I just came from my clinic at the Ambulatory Care Center, where I just saw only 7 patients today. Probably 4 had COPD, and most of them were what we call level 4, the last stage. They're on oxygen. They're on, widespread use of inhaled agents, either metered-dose inhalers or aerosol. And one patient who we share with your colleagues in family medicine, and, I mean, he can't even get out of bed, basically, to get to the wheelchair. He is so short of breath, even simple activities like clothing himself or bathing himself
going
to the bathroom are very, very difficult. But that gives us an opportunity. One of the key things in comprehensive care of our patients is encouraging them to be active within their limits, to rehab them, even if that means walking in the house. That is so good to help them cope with, some of the daily crises that come up. And so we strongly urge every patient, regardless of their level of disease, to try to be able to walk at least or to, have some strategy to be a little more ambulatory.
So it's exercise for the lungs, just by
absolutely
and using your body.
Correct. And the main thing is just walking. And because of this hyperinflation, some of it, this air trapping in your lungs, which make you so short of breath, there is really a nice effect of exercise. I think Adam was just telling me about looking at some exercise studies, and that's vital to try to keep the patients, regardless of what their severity is, to keep them doing things. Now, patients who are better off, we put them in a formal exercise program. That's really can be quite nice.
Well, we're going to need take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Jim Donahue about chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with the Division Chief of Pulmonary Diseases and Critical Care Medicine at UNC, Dr. Jim Donahue, about chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD. And Dr. Donahue, one of the things I'm curious about from your perspective is about any judgment that doctors or the community might place on patients for having this terrible lung disease that's related to their decision to smoke or to continue to smoke, and how that impacts our ability to care for them.
That's an extremely important point, Christine. In fact, thank goodness we're beginning to see some movement in this area. Initially, there was a lot of stigma around smoking, and a lot of physicians felt, well, you brought it on yourself. Mm-hmm. And the only thing you need to do is stop smoking, and you have some defect because you haven't stopped smoking, you're weak.
Like I told you this 5 years ago. I could see how you judge.
And again, I think the point to remember is, yes, some of it is indeed brought upon, but there's some people are susceptible on genetic factors. We have a huge study on COPD gene. The fact is that in some patients, the disease continues on long after you stop smoking because of the inflammatory response due to inherited features and environmental features. And certainly one's not accountable for that. So I think it's time to put all that blame away, and I always listen to the things Adam says about with smoking and how you dealing with that. And there's
the addiction from smoking,
absolutely,
an illness. In a sense, so there's compassion there as well.
Absolutely, and I think we have to assume that with the COPD patient too, and no blame, no guilt. You know, and even if a patient comes in and I read on my vital signs that the patient is still smoking, I don't throw the patient out of the room. This is an opportunity to try to teach the patient about the harm they're doing and to reinforce, you know, the good things that one will get, the benefits if one stops smoking. Then I refer them to Adam.
Thanks. Thank you. Well, speaking of treatment here. But you mentioned a little bit about exercise, and I want to shift us a little bit into effective treatments. What do we know that really does work? And, of course, you've mentioned the smoke cessation, but you started talking about exercise. Talk a little bit more about pulmonary rehabilitation, because I was at, this meeting recently, and I was struck by the fact that we pay routinely and refer our patients for cardiac rehabilitation after many sort of cardiac things. But boy, I don't recall sending too many of my patients for pulmonary rehab, but it seems like there's maybe evidence.
There is evidence that pulmonary rehab is effective because of cost factors. It has not been recognized by insurers, and so it's been difficult. But now Medicare, Medicaid will pay for pulmonary rehab. The benefits are quite good. The first thing is the patients become less short of breath. They're educated by walking. There's tremendous inflammation in your lungs, and that inflammation spills over into the general circulation. And do you know the gastrocnemius muscles of your legs? And my COPD patients are 60% of the non-smoking, non-COPD patient. Much smaller, exactly.
In your legs.
In your legs, right. And so if we do rehab, then we can strengthen those legs. My patients are depressed. That's the result of an inflammatory mediator coming from the lung to the brain. Exercise is very good for people feeling better about themselves. So the benefits are very impressive. That's why even if you can't do a formal program or you don't have insurance, working with really the marvelous people in physical therapy and respiratory therapy, we still come up with some program for the patient to try to help them at home.
Sometimes this comes up in the office of people wanting a handicap sticker to park closer to the door. And in some patients, I'm trying to encourage them, I actually want you to walk across the parking lot because it's good to be active. So it's sounds like at least we're sending a similar message there.
You're absolutely right. You know, the big question, and again, the last thing I want to do is hurt anybody's feelings. I refuse to get a motorized wheelchair or a scooter for a patient with COPD, unless they have arthritis, of course. There are other compelling reasons. But in general, when a patient sits down, their prognosis or their survival is really compromised. I'm not making that up. And I don't quite go to, you have to be a do not resuscitate for.
Right.
But I really completely agree with you. Strongly urge them not to get the scooters and the wheelchair for COPD. Now, there are individual patients that doesn't apply to. But that's sort of a general statement I'd like to make.
What about just some of the – we know behavioral things. We know about exercise. Drugs that do work and that are relatively safe. What do we know?
Yes, the drugs are not as important as in asthma, where they're definitely controllers. The drugs are really for symptom modification. And so the safer drugs, because remember, this is an older population, all have comorbidities, all have heart disease. One-third of our patients die of heart disease, one-third cancer, one-third COPD. So we have to take that into account. So inhaled drugs are safer. Bronchodilators, either the anti-cholinergic, that would be drugs like Spiriva, fixed drug combinations.
To cut down on mucus
and expand the lung, reduce the hyperinflation. And then there's Advair 250/50, which is the long-acting beta agonist, salmeterol, and fluticasone.
So again, to cut down inflammation and expand the lungs.
Absolutely. And Symbicort is the third, fluticasone. And this is really where I work, and we have a number of agents before the Food and Drug Administration, but unfortunately I was 0 for 3 last year, three drugs that I was involved with. I presented that at the FDA. Four various study groups were turned down for various reasons, but we're still optimistic.
So there are new drugs on the horizon that just aren't yet approved?
Yeah, but they're just tweaking the existing drugs. I don't think
there's not enough research here?
Well, no, there's research, but we can't find anything. Well, there's a little bit of funding, but we don't find anything that works. Uh-huh. So what the companies have done, we have good bronchodilators, but everybody keeps coming up with better bronchodilators once a day versus twice a day.
Right.
And these are very, very small increments in benefit to our patients. They're good and they're safe, but we need something that would really modify that inflammation down deep in the lung and better therapies. And we have, I'm very pleased, like at UNC, some groups that previously didn't look at COPD, who used to look at CF and cystic fibrosis and other diseases are now helping us.
Okay.
And I think that's going to be revolutionary because they really will look at it differently with different types of agents.
Speaking of help, you mentioned the statewide coalition.
The North Carolina COPD Coalition.
Sounds novel. What's going on?
And this is a terrific program led by people like Roy Pleasance, who's a PharmD, who you know at Duke and Campbell University, Winston Lau, physicians like myself, Jill O'Hart, Wake Forest, folks at Duke, Monica Kraft. And what we've all come together, and first thing we did was on the behavioral survey that's done every year by the CDC, we added 9 questions, respiratory questions, and we did this about 6 or 7 years ago. So we got a real sense of the impact of the disease on our state. For example, we learned that those who had a physician diagnosed COPD, it was as impactful as those who had a diabetes kind of diagnosis. And subsequently, we've refined those questions and have done them every year. Now other states are modeling off of us. We have a meeting every year at the Friday Center that's attended by 300.
So you're educating physicians, you're educating patients, getting those 10 million that are undiagnosed, better diagnosed, really trying to strip away the hiddenness of the disease, I would say.
Absolutely. And we educate about 350 people at Friday Center every year with a big meeting. And it involves lots of different people, pharmacists, respiratory therapists, physical therapists, nurses, and, of course, and then the MDs, researchers. And so we're all trying to attack this disease. And we put up models in little communities like Asheboro for emergency room physicians, another demonstration. We've gotten state support on it. So these are things that I'm very excited about that. I hope it comes to fruition.
So we know you've had some experience in Hollywood.
And before we end, we got to hear what's happening in Hollywood, Dr. Donahue.
Well, my daughter's an actress, and but anyway, I had a one-upper a little bit. So last week I was in Hollywood, and I think it's the public radio television station WCET, and I filmed a 1-hour continuing education program. So now I can say Sunset Boulevard. I've been there, done that, and have the T-shirt.
Speaking of education, what do you think are the top three things that people should know, that patients should know, listeners should know about COPD?
For their family member who may have it or who may be short of breath and hasn't even been diagnosed.
Okay. Most importantly, if you're about age 50, late 40s and 50s, and you have symptoms of shortness of breath or cough, any kind of exertion, go to your family doctor and get a spirometry, which is a single test that can diagnose the condition. And we have all kinds of standards. That's really the most important thing. And of course, stop smoking if you're still smoking, and keep walking. Don't sit down. I think we talked about that today, you know, with Adam and you, Christy, and I think that is so important. And I think people will live a lot healthier and with a lot better quality of life if they sort of know what they have and then deal with it.
Well, we've been talking with Dr. Jim Donahue, Division Chief of Pulmonary Disease, University of North Carolina. Thank you so much. I think you really have helped us feel that, and our listeners feel that this is something that we as a state can be leaders on,
right,
and really help people. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend some time talking about your health questions and concerns.
You can send us your own questions to yourhealth@unc.edu, and we're going to listen to our very first question today. What do we have?
What causes your hearing to get muffled in that really high-pitched, annoying ring? And why does it always happen randomly in just one ear?
What'd you say, Christy? Okay, bad joke here.
Because
actually,
it can really be bothersome.
Oh, and I've had this. I've actually had this where, you know, particularly it seems to happen always right when you're about to fly somewhere, that you get a cold and you get a blocked ear, and then you get on a plane and it's very painful.
And that high-pitched ring in your ear, most people will, the technical term for that is tinnitus, or some call it tinnitus, which is kind of inflammation in that ear that can, or a lot of different things in your ear that can cause that ear ringing. Can be from loud noises or concerts, from inflammation, as you're talking
about,
Adam. Or someone
screaming in your ear, like accidentally, or infection. I mean, a lot of things that can cause it.
Sure. There's something called Meniere's disease, that if you have hearing loss associated with it, it could be that.
But the most common thing here is, you know, people have colds and they get swelling in their back of their throat where the eustachian tube drains. And when that closes off, fluid builds up behind the middle ear. And when fluid builds up in the ear canals, your hearing gets muffled.
And usually that will go away if that's the case, that over time, you know, your body just clears it and that inflammation can improve and it sort of opens up on its own.
And I don't know why it randomly happens in one ear. It seems like a lot of people, it's one ear is worse than the other at times. You know, what I say sometimes, if you can pinch your nose and blow out and kind of clear it, that's a good sign. But when you can't do that, that's a sign that there's too much fluid there and you're going to probably have to do something and like saline nasal spray, try to shrink those nasal passages.
And if it doesn't go away quickly, or if you're having problems with hearing loss or you're taking medications, I would run that by your doctor, because there are other things that could be going on.
Absolutely. Well, what's our very next house call? We actually have a couple questions that we received this week about potty training. Let's listen to our very first one about potty training house call.
My son is 3 years old and seems to be exhibiting some of the traditional signs of being ready for potty training, being able to talk about it, being able to identify when he has to go use the restroom. But whenever we broach the subject, he doesn't seem to have any interest in actually sitting on the potty. We hear conflicting suggestions from doctors and laypersons alike to say, about 50-50, to say, well, go ahead and put him in underwear and let him run around the house one weekend and let him get used to that feeling. Others say he'll tell us when he's ready. I just would love to hear a little bit more about what does ready really mean?
Great question. What does ready really mean? Well, Christy, you've got some younger kids. I have blocked out that memory of potty training.
Oh, man.
It's gone. Was it a problem? No, it was easy. Wrong.
I know. I wish that I was through this time because it's hard work, potty training.
Are the kids potty trained?
Well, my older daughter is, but my son, who just turned 3, we're in the process, in the thick of it now. So I feel like this question is one that I want to ask as well. Like, how do you make it happen as quickly as possible? But what does ready mean is really the undertone of this question. And, you know, there are certain developmental skills that you have to think about before you even embark on this.
Yeah, you know, a child really has to be ready. And what we would say is that there are certain skills and observations. You know, can the child literally walk to the toilet, sit up on the toilet, and can they stay dry for several hours after they get up from a nap? These are certain beginning signs.
Can they pull their clothes up and down and follow some simple instructions? Can they communicate their need to go to the bathroom? And do they have that ability to say no and have some independence? But the big thing with readiness is an interest.
Yep.
This is where I've struggled with my son of just, he's just not very interested. And so until the child really wants to do it, it's hard. And you may be spending more time sort of trying to push the idea on the child.
And that is a problem because then you have this tension and there may be some fears and the child already developmentally wants to say no in this stage. And so an ability to say no becomes there and you become this tug of war. In addition, which it can take several months, can it, Christy?
The average time is 6 months of toilet training.
So for our listener right here, this question, it may be that this is a process that they're going through. So kind of your friends are right on both sides of the element, but it's only a piece of the story.
And I did want to answer your question about putting them in underwear and letting them run around. There are lots of different strategies. You can get books on like potty training boot camps to keep them naked in the house or put them in underwear. And I have heard that putting them in underwear when they're ready and meeting these milestones can kind of shorten your window for training, but you're going to have a lot of mess. So you need to be ready to sort of deal with that in a positive way and just try to keep it positive.
And there's one more piece of advice here. They will grow out of it eventually.
I keep saying he won't go to high school still in diapers.
Well, let's listen to our very next question because I think this is a little bit different, but also concerns about potty training, very legitimate concerns.
I have a 2-year-old daughter that's been essentially potty trained for about 2 weeks and just a couple days ago started complaining of pain when she would go to the restroom and only does it on occasion, not every time that she uses the restroom, and just curious as to when is it appropriate to take her in to see her pediatrician for further workup.
So we have a little bit younger daughter than in our previous listener there, and also that this has been going on for about 2 weeks. So Christy, one of the things I hear is that maybe a lot of listeners, and maybe we haven't done as good a job as providers, is really educating this 6-month idea that this takes quite a long time in a lot of people. It's not just something that happens over 2 or 3 weeks.
Right. Well, like anything else in parenting, you hear some friend tell you, oh, I potty trained in 1 weekend. And so you feel this pressure to get it done quickly. And it's not fun to do. But
there can be some issues here that we would have some concerns about, about pain and could possibly be a bladder infection, even though that's more rare.
Yeah, I think if you've been working on it for a couple of weeks and the child is not showing interest or showing some resistance, that would be a good time to back off and give it another several weeks to months before starting again. But if there's truly pain with urination or any fever associated with that, well, that could be a bladder infection, and you'd want to have that checked out by your doctor.
Yeah, the fact this only occurs on occasion is certainly reassuring, and taking her to her pediatrician or family doctor, either one would be appropriate. Most times this is more likely to be, particularly in this process, part of the process. And so trusting your instincts here, I think, would be something I would encourage you to do.
And good luck to you. We should all have a little party at the end. Moms unite, a potty party.
Wait, moms and dads, Christy.
That's true.
Okay.
Me, that wasn't fair.
That's okay. What's our very last house call today?
So, Adam, I'm one of your semi-retired colleagues, a physician. And at age 66, I have a question regarding screening of men with PSAs. As a provider and as a patient, this is something I think it's difficult to decide on because there's recommendations to get them by some experts and recommendations to not get them by other experts. And I'm curious what you would say about it.
Well, thank you. I think I recognize the voice, but I won't give it away over here since you're one of my colleagues here and one of Christy's colleagues here. But, you know, your question's a good one. And even as a physician, you're at the age and educated, you know this is a very difficult question.
It's a complicated question because it depends a lot on a person's values. There can be false positive tests, or meaning PSAs that are elevated, that are because of something else, not from cancer. And then you also might detect a cancer of the prostate that would never have caused you any problems. And it may be true for you that maybe you'd rather not know. If it's not going to cause you a problem, maybe it's better just not to know that you have prostate cancer.
Yeah, you know, I think both Christy and I and a lot of our physician colleagues are much less likely to recommend them now than we were 2 years ago. And, you know, but the conversation is such a difficult conversation and a long one. And patients and our listeners, you oftentimes ask us, well, what would you do if it were yourself? So here, I'll give an answer. I am not going to have a PSA test done on me. I will have a digital rectal examination at the appropriate time, but I don't believe the test is a good enough test to justify it. I will try to do everything else I can to lower my risk of prostate cancer, but I'm not going to have the test.
And I can't answer that question since I don't have a prostate, but I do try really hard to embark on a real conversation with my patients to, as much as possible, try to understand
If you decide to have it, it's reasonable. And also, if you're high risk, if you have a family history of prostate cancer, this really changes the dynamics of the conversation.
Thank you so much for your question. It's a tough one.
Well, let's review. We've had a good chance to talk about prostate cancer, PSA tests, and potty training. High-pitched hearing loss.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your questions and for joining us today on Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you. And we want you to share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu or call us at 919-966-8081.
You can also send us a Twitter and give us a question. We'll address it on an upcoming show. We'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, and UNC Healthcare, as well as our great guest today, Dr. Jim Donahue. Please join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.